Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's Greatest Briton is Sir Francis Galton, and of course my co-host for the programme will be Max Musson. Well, shall we get into our Greatest Briton for this week, Max?
Okay.
One that you've chosen. I think I'd heard his name before, but I hadn't really looked into him. He's quite a fascinating character. I mean, very, very, very intelligent. We're going to be talking about Sir Francis Galton this week. And Sir Francis Galton was an English Victorian era statistician and a polymath and a sociologist, a psychologist, an anthropologist, a eugenicist. In actual fact, he coined the term eugenics, a tropical explorer, a geographer, an inventor, a meteorologist, a protogeneticist, and a psychometrician. He was born 16th of February 1822 and was knighted in 1909 at the age of 86 before dying on January the 17th, 1911. Unfortunately, he was only able to enjoy being a knight for 2 years. He was actually the father of psychometrics, which is concerned with the objective measurement of skills and knowledge, abilities, attitudes, personality traits, and educational achievement. Something which we would suggest is different just as much as it is for individuals as it is among races. He also coined the term eugenics and the phrase nature versus nurture. He was the first to apply statistical methods to the study of human differences and the inheritance of intelligence, and his book Hereditary Genius was the first social scientific attempt to study genius and greatness. Outside of psychology, he devised a method for classifying fingerprints that proved useful in forensic science, and as the initiator of scientific meteorology, he devised the first weather map, proposed a theory of anticyclones, and was the first to establish a complete record of short-term climatic phenomena on a European scale. He also invented the Galton whistle for testing differential hearing ability. I mean, this man is a superhero. He's an uber brain. He's just an uber genius. And it's incredible that we had people like this among us that are just excel at absolutely everything. And you know, these are the people that should be raised up and given titles and that we should be learning about and realizing that we have these people among us. And the more we import people with low average IQ, the more we allow them to interbreed with us, the less we are going to have these super human types that are born among us. And he realized this. I mean, he invented the term eugenics. Max, I know you've read some work about him and you've also studied him before. What do you think about this brief outline of his life? Is there more that should be said there?
Well, I think that we've celebrated in the past people who've been kings and queens and who've excelled in terms of statecraft. We've celebrated people who've been explorers. We've celebrated people who've been soldiers and adventurers. And I think as far as Sir Francis Galton is concerned, you know, he wasn't a soldier. He wasn't a king. But he was somebody who was a tropical explorer and a geographer. And he had so much more also that was of an intellectual gift to give to the nation. And that's really where he excelled. You know, the term polymath is perhaps not widely understood by the majority of people. Polymath just means that we're talking about somebody who has a very high academic ability in a very wide variety of fields. So some people become very highly skilled and expert in narrow fields where outside their narrow field, they really are no better than the average person in terms of their knowledge or in terms of their intuitive ability. Whereas a polymath is somebody who has got wide ranging knowledge and the ability to apply both knowledge and intelligence in a wide range of different things in order to push forward the boundaries, not just to be somebody who is like a jack of all trades, but he's somebody who is excellent in a very large number of areas of academic endeavor, basically. And that's why he, you know, he invented things. He, you know, meteorology, people, that sort of trips off the tongue very, very easily. But, you know, he was the person who pioneered the prediction of the weather. And when we think how important that is to everybody's everyday lives today, that we're able to predict weather patterns around the world, you know, nobody had done it before he did it. And so that's something that we can put down to Sir Francis Galton. Sir Francis Galton is denigrated by a lot of academics nowadays because of the fact that his work is considered to be, or some large areas of his work are considered to be politically incorrect and considered to be racist or fascistic. But the point of the matter is that Sir Francis Galton was a man of very, very high caliber in a wide range of fields, and certainly somebody who we should be celebrating as one of our greatest Britons.
Well, everything that he did was based on fact. I mean, this was a scientist, a man who was trying to find the truth about things. So whether it's politically incorrect or it's taboo subjects today, it doesn't take away from the fact that he was correct in what he was doing. And it seems to me today we have the image of the genius, and it will be somebody that's very good at theoretical physics, and they'll be quite autistic, and they'll be short-sighted, and they'll probably have not very good at social skills. Whereas looking at this man, the fact that he was a tropical explorer, and we'll hear he did quite a bit of exploratory work, that shows that he was physically very fit as well. And he lived for a very long time. So he is an alpha male, not just good physically, but very good mentally, just good all round at everything, like a very almost perfect example of what a white man should be, basically. We need more people like this.
And one of the other things we've mentioned just briefly as well is the developing the classifying of fingerprints and identifying people through fingerprints. Again, it's something which you can say, and it sounds quite trite and doesn't seem to have a great amount of impact. But when you consider the number of crimes that have been solved over the last century or more as a result of the police having fingerprint techniques available to them, it is, you know, mind-boggling. And those crimes wouldn't have been solved necessarily if it hadn't been for Sir Francis Galton. So, you know, he's reached into probably every one of our lives in a number of different areas that we've been totally unaware of, and that is part of his greatness.
I think Dr. Edward Dutton, he's done work on the percentage of geniuses that are born. It's gradually been going down. It gets less and less each year per the number of the population and the number of geniuses that are actually being born, because we have a dysgenic system today. We reward people that are least likely to produce the brightest children, and everything reverts to the mean anyway, which is another thing that he discovered, is that everything reverts to the mean, and we get these geniuses at one end, and we get people that are really not very bright at the other. And what Edward Dutton has shown is that we are now getting less and less geniuses, and importing people with a low average IQ into the country as well. This just adds to it. And the fact that we've made eugenics into a taboo. I mean, that is just incredible that we could make, you know, the idea of improving the your race, improving your people, improving your nation in the same way that we try to improve cattle and we try to improve horses. The idea that we would make that taboo, I mean, that really just shows you that we live in a totally corrupt society that does the opposite of what it should be doing. Well, let's have a look at his early life. In his youth, he was also Charles Darwin's half-cousin, sharing his grandfather Erasmus Darwin with him. So this tells us that intelligence passes down through the family. This was all something that he was very interested in as well, was the inheritability of intelligence. Galton was a child prodigy. He was reading by the age of 2. At age 5, he knew some Greek, Latin, and long division, and by the age of 6, he had moved on to adult books, including Shakespeare for pleasure and poetry, which he quoted at length. And today, they like to say that Everybody is all the same, and if only the less bright people had the attention or went to the posh schools, they would be just as bright as everybody else. And I think this shows us that this isn't true. I mean, he was reading at the age of two. He knew Greek, Latin, a long division. How did he learn all of that? If he hadn't ever had bright parents to teach him this, he wouldn't have been able to learn all of this. And it is inherited, the same as musical talents. If you're a musician, that's inherited in your family. If you're a very intelligent person, that will be inherited in your family. People that are good with their hands, that is inherited from your ancestors. Everything we see around us shows us that we are not all the same. We inherit these things, and the races are just as different as the individuals are. And I think these child prodigies, I think this helps to demonstrate this. And this must have been something that he was very interested in, because it did shape his life later on. What do you make of this? The fact that he was a child prodigy and Charles Darwin's half cousin, Max?
Yeah, I think one of the things that probably interested him in the heritability of intelligence was the recognition of the fact that he and a number of his close relatives all shared this ability in terms of having a wide ranging intellect, and so what for him was perhaps just a truism of his own immediate family, then he then realized that it was actually something that that had a much wider application. I think that one of the pieces of work that he did, one of the pieces of investigation that he made, was into the value of children. This is something that, you know, we're sort of planning to go through in a bit greater detail later on. But effectively, what he did was to get an actuary who to evaluate the monetary cost of raising a child from a baby to the point where the child could start to earn their own living, and the monetary value of supporting that person in old age with a pension, etc., and then compared that with the monetary value to our society of that person working during their working years. The outcome that he had was that if you started off with somebody who was the average son of a navvy, and I know there are exceptions that break the rule, that you do get some navvies who don't achieve a higher station in life just purely because that they've had a lot of bad breaks or whatever along the way, and they are intrinsically still very intelligent people, but by and large, people who work through manual labour are not the brightest when it comes to academic work. And basically what he discovered was that if you analyse the costs of the value to the nation of having somebody who is the son of a manual worker versus somebody who equivalent to a Nobel Prize winning scientist, then there is just a massive gulf between the two. In which the person who is the child of of somebody who has already who has previously achieved very high levels of attainment in their own particular field of study or endeavor, that person's value to the nation is infinitely greater than the value of somebody who the average child of somebody who does manual labor. And it's something that a lot of people who've got sympathy for people who do manual labour may think is cruel and unkind to point out, but it's the fact that it is unpleasant for those for people in that position to recognise doesn't make it less true. It still is just as true. And so one of the principles that he outlined was that if there was a source of people you could buy, a source of children that you could buy, where those children were all of the same intellectual quality and had the same physical abilities, etc., as people who have excelled in their own particular field of endeavor in the past, then that there is nothing that a nation could spend its money on more and gain greater reward than buying lots and lots of these babies. And so basically what part of his eugenic part of what he advocated from a eugenic point of view was that for people of high achievement to have large families and to have more children was extremely beneficial for the nation, and infinitely more so than the benefit of people who are manual workers having children. And by the way, you know, he didn't say that manual workers having children was a bad thing. He did apply a value to the children of manual workers, but it was just nothing like as high once you took all the other factors into account as the value to a nation of having children from a family that had excelled in some respect. And so as far as eugenics is concerned, eugenics has been given a bad name in recent times, partly because it's been misunderstood, partly because the people who've advocated it in the past have always advocated eugenic principles and measures in order to bring about a eugenic effect that are negative, which focus on stopping people who are not great achievers from having children, whereas the focus for eugenics should be the other way around. It should be to encourage people who have excelled and do excel to have more children and larger families, and that in itself will bring about a eugenic effect. As far as people who are not as greatly valued as the high achievers from the point of view of the nation are concerned, it is of benefit to them for the proportion of our society being born to people who have excelled in their particular field of endeavor, because what it means is that the gene pool that their children have to choose from is a gene pool made up of better quality people. And so it then means that once their children marry and have children, their children will be better quality people than they were, just as the children of the highest achieving families, by choosing people that are also high achieving, the children of high achieving families to have to produce children with, will also produce children that are of better quality than they are. Eugenics is a process of increasing the quality of the humans that make up, or the individuals that make up any particular population of people and that make up a nation. And by pursuing eugenic principles, you can massively reduce the vulnerability to disease. You can massively reduce the incidence of deformities. You can massively increase the proportion of people within a nation who have excellent musical skills, who have excellent artistic skills, who have excellent statistical and mathematical skills, who have leadership skills, or you know, qualities in whatever area you think of. And that can't ever be bad for a nation. It's always got to be good for a nation. The only thing that can be bad about eugenics is if there is, as I mentioned earlier, if there is an undue focus on the negative, on negative ways of creating the change that we want to see. And you know, those negative ways were what tended to be focused on during the first half of the 20th century, and that's a great shame.
Here you go, positive and negative eugenics. Positive rewarding the bright people for producing children, and the negative sterilizing the criminal types. And criminal types do go down in the family, just the same as the bright types get passed down in the family. But I would say that, I mean, we have to have the navvies, we have to have the types that do labouring, and it would be best for them to be high testosterone and have lots of muscles, and you wouldn't need to be breeding for the brightest types. You'd just be needing to breed the strongest types, basically, and even then their lives would be improved, because the more genius types you have, the more inventions they make, the higher the quality of life for everyone. So regardless of whether, you know, the brawny types, whether their daughters were able to marry the intelligent types or not, their lives would still be improved. The quality of life would be raised for everybody. As you say, there would be less disease, there'd be less congenital deformities. I mean, I thought recently that just the very fact that we have medicine which keeps the sickly types and the weaker types, it keeps them alive, and then they can breed. And that introduces weakness into the nation, and you get more people that are sick. If we didn't have medicine, we could feasibly have people that just don't ever get sick. We'd have people that weren't short-sighted, people that were living to the very utmost of their genetics, basically. And I think when we go back 2,000 years to the time of the Greeks and the Romans, that's what we had. Look at the physique of those statues that they made back then. I mean, they were high testosterone. Our testosterone has dropped by 20% on average just in the last 20 years. And
it's not a matter of not making medicine available to those people that need it. If people are born today and they need medicine, we should give them medicine so that they can lead as good a life as they possibly can. But what we should do is raise people to recognize the fact that they do need medicine to a greater extent than other people do, and that therefore, from the point of view of the good of the nation, they should think about, it shouldn't be forced upon them, they should think about having fewer children. I don't advocate a eugenic system where people who are, perhaps might be regarded at the least desirable end of the scale with whatever you think you're considering, that those people shouldn't have any children at all, because I think everybody should have a vested interest in the future of our nation, and so therefore everybody should be entitled to have children, and nobody should be forced not to have children, but people should be raised to recognize And not to feel shame, because there's no shame about it, because nobody is responsible for the genes that they've inherited. So nobody should be made to feel guilty because of the genes that they've inherited. But the point is that people who've got the less desirable genes and who can recognize that fact, or have been educated to recognize that fact, should just have fewer children. And at the other end of the scale, people who have got qualities, so therefore, if we're looking at susceptibility to disease, if we find that there are people who never go to see the doctor, who never have a disease, who basically shrug off every disease you can possibly imagine, then that particular person has got a quality that is something that it would benefit the nation to pass on.
Well, 150 years ago, everybody was like that. 150 years ago, everybody was like that. This is the thing. 90% of the people that are around today wouldn't have survived to adulthood 150 years ago, and it's only in the last 150 years that we've had all this medicine. We never had it 1,000 years ago, and the people that were around were the very fit people that wouldn't be passing on these diseases. I mean, we can't go backwards. We have to use medicine now. But if you look at it in that way, it has actually caused the deterioration in the nation. And obviously you have to compensate for that deterioration, and a way to compensate for it is the way that you suggested there, Max, not encouraging people that are weak and sickly and need lots of medicine, not encouraging them to breed, and those that are extremely fit, like Galton was, lived to a long age, super bright, you would encourage them to breed. You would give them incentives. You would give them money off a mortgage, say, or you would give the mother extra family allowance, so that they've got more money. There are ways of doing this without sterilizing people and forcing people not to have children. But the idea of actually improving the physical and physicality of the race, and also the spirituality and the mental capacities, how that can be seen as something negative is just, it's just beyond me. I say it just really does indict our civilization as a dysgenic one that has taken a wrong turn somewhere. Well, what have we got next? We've got his travels. Shall we get into his travels next time? Do you want to add anything to the eugenics discussion, Max? And we'll get into his travels next week.
I can't think of anything immediately that I'd like to sort of add. So let's do it next week. Yes.
Shall we talk about something positive, Max? Shall we talk about Sir Francis Galton?
Yes, let's talk about him.
Let's get into Sir Francis Galton, our greatest Briton for the week. Last week, we briefly talked about him being a polymath and the many disciplines he excelled in, alongside some of his pioneering work, including inventing weather forecasts and fingerprinting, as well as being the father of eugenics, which we also discussed alongside some debate on medicine being dysgenic. We also talked about the difference between positive and negative eugenics, and Max explained how the value of a child born to labourer parents can be calculated against the value to the nation of a child born to artisan or intellectual genius parents, and how if the child of either could be purchased, the value of the second would be infinitely more than the value of the first, although the first is still essential for a functioning society. So you can put a numerical value on the people that actually make up society. And obviously you want to have the best people in your society, which is what eugenics is. And today we have this dysgenic society that rewards and encourages those who are least likely to excel, to breed, and those who are most likely to excel, the bright people, they're encouraged not to breed at all. I mean, so many bright women now are encouraged to go out and have a career and not have children, for a start. Do you want to add anything to that? Anything else that you remember from last week that you wanted to bring up there, Max, before we get into his travels?
There was the issue that I mentioned with regard to him recognizing that human inequality, and I think that's one of the things that that both in our society and other societies in Western countries around the world, we've got to recognise that human individuals are unequal in terms of the abilities that they've got, and the guiding spirit within our country has got to be one in which not only do we recognise that, but the systems that we operate and the culture that we create embodies that kind of thing as well. And one of the things that Galton went on to say was that the importance of eugenics was such that eugenics could almost become should almost be regarded as a religion, and that our religion should incorporate eugenic principles, should incorporate eugenic principles so that it becomes a permanent facet of our society. If I just read you some extracts from the book that I've got, Essays in Eugenics, it says here that eugenics strengthens the sense of social duty in so many important particulars that the conclusions derived from its study ought to find a welcome home in every tolerant religion. It promotes a far-sighted philanthropy, the acceptance of parentage as a serious responsibility, and a higher conception of patriotism. The creed of eugenics is founded upon the idea of evolution, not on a passive form of it, but on one that can, to some extent, direct its own course. And so this is an important element that we are the product of human evolution, but as far as mankind is concerned, we have now achieved a level of technological ability such that we can insulate ourselves from the natural forces that have guided the evolution of our species over the last several 100,000 years, and that if that evolution isn't to either come to an end or to take some disastrous turn, then we need to accept responsibility for guiding our own evolution. And the guiding of our own evolution is an aspect of eugenics. And he says, furthermore, evolution is in any case a grand phantasmagoria, but it assumes an infinitely more interesting aspect under the knowledge that the intelligent action of the human will is in some small measure capable of guiding its course.
That fits in with the survival of the fittest, isn't it? You know, you want the survival of the fittest, because then you haven't got people that are sick and ill and not getting the most out of life. You want people that are not going to be ill, that are going to have the right amount of testosterone, that are going to have good eyesight, that are going to have a high IQ, that are capable of improving their surroundings, rather than people who rely upon other people to look after them. We want more people that are capable of looking after others, not people that need looking after. I think that's what it really boils down to. Because, as you say, we've become insulated from nature now, and we've got all this this medicine which increases life and keeps people alive who before would have died while they were infants, and that gives them a chance to reproduce, and then we get more of them, and a lot of them would get these dysgenic ideas, these anti-white ideas, these liberal ideas. You know, there's studies that have been done that show that the people that come out with these left-wing ideas, you know, they are objectively ugly, and they're objectively ugly because they have all these mutant genes. They have all these genes which shouldn't be there, which wouldn't have made their way to adulthood 100 years ago. So we've got this dysgenic society. Sorry, Max, I interrupted you there. Did you want to add something else?
Well, the final passage of the book I've highlighted here is that continued studies will be required for some time to come, and the pace must not be hurried. When the desired fullness of information shall have been acquired, then will be the fit moment to proclaim a jihad, or holy war, against customs and prejudices that impair the physical and moral qualities of our race, which sort of plants Galton very firmly in a very sort of militant form of eugenic advocacy, I think.
Well, you brought up religion there, and it should be a part of religion. And, you know, if you look at the Christian religion, it tells you that man was made in the image of God. And if you have a man that's genetically deformed, I mean, that's a mockery of God. And that person is not going to lead the fullest of lives that he could live. I mean, so even religiously, you could go along with this. You could say that, you know, that man was created perfect, and that is the way that he should be. And we should be striving for perfection, and we should be doing all we can to prevent deformities and people that aren't going to live up to the fullest of expectations. They're not going to lead the best lives. We should be trying to prevent them from being born. If they are born, I'm not saying, you know, they should be badly treated, but we should be we shouldn't be encouraging their birth. Because it just means that gradually, all the superior excellenceness becomes swamped in mediocrity, and you know this plays in with immigration as well, which you know, because he understood the differences between the races. But we'll get more into his eugenics later on. Before he actually got to discovering that and giving it the name eugenics, he had actually done. He'd actually made quite a few other achievements. As we say, he's a polymath, and he excelled in many of these disciplines. And the first thing that he actually did was went travelling, and that was really where he made his name. He took up medicine and mathematical studies at first, but when his father died, he terminated his studies. And as he was financially cared for, because he came from a good home, obviously he had wealthy parents, wealthy ancestors, because they had a high IQ, which gets passed on down through the generations. So he was wealthy enough to be able to do whatever he wanted, basically. So he decided to do some traveling, and he went through Eastern Europe to Constantinople, and then along the Nile from Egypt to the Sudan, and along the Jordan to Beirut and Damascus. And in 1850, he joined the Royal Geographical Society, and over the next 2 years mounted a long and difficult expedition into the then little known Southwest Africa, which is now called Namibia, which became the basis for his book, Narrative of an Explorer in Southwest Africa. And after winning 2 medals for his survey of Africa, he then wrote the bestseller, The Art of Travel, a handbook of practical advice for the Victorian on the move, which went through many editions and is still in print. I would like to see that. You know, I'm quite jealous of these Victorians that were able to go to these places, you know, at the height of the British Empire, and still feel as if they were discovering new things, and they were setting a good example. And this, you know, this confirms what we said in the last episode about him obviously being very physically fit, as well as being extremely bright, which would go along with this idea of if you've got good genes, then you're going to be bright and you're going to have good ideas. And it's reflected in the physicality, of the person. I'm not sure, was the Ottoman Empire still going at this time? He's going along the Jordan to Beirut and Damascus. Was that a part of the Ottoman Empire, or was it part of the British Empire at that time?
I don't think it would have been part of the British Empire. I think it's more likely to be part of the Ottoman Empire or perhaps some other configuration of Arab states. I don't think that we occupied. Oh, I think we occupied the Middle East during the First World War, and so obviously that is about 70 years later, isn't it? It was 70 years later than the 1850 when he conducted his expedition.
So he's in enemy territory as well. He's not travelling in the British Empire here. He's travelling within the Ottoman Empire. And also you can see that while he was in Africa, he must have had a lot of experience with the natives, which must have taught him a lot as well.
Yes.
Well, after that, we get to his middle years. And since he was a polymath, he made many contributions to many different fields of science, including meteorology, the anticyclone and the first popular weather maps, statistics, which was regression and correlation, psychology, synesthesia. That's an interesting one. That's when you hear colours or you taste sounds. It's the blending of
sensory perception.
Sensory perception, yeah. But blending of the senses, biology, the nature and mechanism of heredity, the fact that we inherit so much of ourselves, we inherit from our parents and from our ancestors. And criminology, fingerprints. If it wasn't for him, then we wouldn't have the technology and the ability to solve crimes by people's fingerprints. And much of this was influenced by his penchant for counting and measuring, because he would look at these statistics, he'd make all these charts up, and then he would work out what the average was and look at what you could predict from looking at these statistics. And he was one of the first people to do that. He prepared the first weather map, published in the Times on the 1st of April 1875, showing the weather from the previous day, which is now a standard feature in newspapers worldwide. He became very active in the British Association for the Advancement of Science, presenting many papers on a wide variety of topics at its meetings from 1858 to 1899. He was the General Secretary from 63 to 67, President of the Geographical Section in 67 and 72, and President of the Anthropological Section in 77 and 85. So he's obviously very interested in anthropology and the study of different races, different tribes, and the different cultures that they have. And he was actually active on the Council of the Royal Geographical Society for over 40 years in various committees of the Royal Society and on the Meteorological Council. And in 1888, he established a lab in the science galleries of the South Kensington Museum. And in Galton's lab, participants could be measured to gain knowledge of their strengths and weaknesses. And Galton then used this data for his own research. And he would typically charge people a small fee for his services. So I guess he wouldn't just physically measure them. He would measure their intelligence. And this is before we had IQ tests, and he would ask these questions about people's personality and then give them these predictions, and at the same time save all that data up so that he could then use it to find out in more general about people and about different races, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that you mentioned in that was his penchant for measuring things, and there's a saying in the world of business that you can't manage what you can't measure, and so that's why businesses employ lots of accountants to keep track of the number of business transactions and the frequency of this and the frequency of that, so that they can manage the way in which their business grows and can make their business grow by managing it properly, and so that fits in very well with this approach that Galton had of measuring things and analyzing the data to identify patterns, and so that he could then come forward with his theories as to how we should manage the growth and reproduction of our population to the best advantage.
Yeah, he wasn't very impressed with superstition, was he? You think, you know, in the past, people would try to make predictions, you know, they would look at entrails or, you know, you get your palms red or whatever. And he came up with the idea of, no, we'll measure as much as we can, and then we'll collate all the measurements that we have, and then we'll use that to try and predict what's going to happen in the future. As you say, that this is done all the time now to try and predict what the markets are going to do. Well, we've mentioned before that he was related to Charles Darwin. I think he was his cousin. And Charles Darwin published The Origin of the Species in 1859. And Galton found the first chapter on variation under domestication, which concerned animal breeding, to be of particular importance. And of course, this is about the improvements that you make in say, horses, or improvements that farmers make in their stock that they have of cows, and they get the best stallion or the best bull, and they continue to breed the best animals that they possibly can. It's the same with horticulture. You know, the growers try to grow the best flowers and the best plants that they can. So he saw this and he understood this, and he thought, well, why aren't we doing this with humans? So he then devoted much of the rest of his life to exploring all the variations that could be found in human populations and what their implications were, which is something that Darwin had only hinted at. And in doing so, he established a research program which embraced multiple aspects of human variation, from mental characteristics to height, from facial images to fingerprint patterns. This required inventing novel measures of traits, devising a large-scale collection of data using those measures, and in the end, the discovery of new statistical techniques for describing and understanding the data. And I bet there's a hell of a lot of politically incorrect conclusions that he reached from this. I bet they discovered that, obviously they would have discovered that criminality passed down through the family, but they also probably would have discovered that there were certain physical measurements that you could make of people that could predict whether they were likely to be criminal. I know about 100 years ago, they said that there was a particular criminal type that you could see just from looking at people. I know Dr. Edward Dutton brought out a book last year, how you can judge people by what they look like, because you can judge people by what they look like. And this is what he was doing, basically. And it's fascinating stuff here.
Yeah, absolutely. The importance of Sir Francis Galton is that he has touched the everyday lives of virtually everybody in this country. You know, because a lot of people in academia nowadays will denigrate Galton on the basis that he was a eugenicist, and eugenicism being, or interest in eugenics being comparable to being a Nazi, effectively. And so he'll be denigrated on that basis. And so you can quite imagine that the Black Lives Matter people sort of protesting about a statue of Galton that might be somewhere. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, he invented meteorology, effectively. He invented fingerprinting, and he invented the statistical many methods of statistical analysis. You mentioned regression and correlation that are used in virtually every dissertation. There will be some kind of statistical analysis to prove the theory, the theory behind the dissertation, and the statistical methods that are used to do that and to are a product of Francis Galton's work. And so anybody who's gone to university and got a degree in any subject that requires any kind of numbers to prove the thesis, also anybody that's been burgled and had the police come in and fingerprint the house and found the fingerprints and then been able to find the culprit based on those fingerprints, and you know, those people will have all benefited from the fact that from the work of Francis Galton in developing fingerprinting, and again, weather prediction. Anybody who has looks at what the predicted weather is going to be for the day before they decide whether they're going to put their coat on or not when they go out, you know, anybody who does that will also be benefiting from the work of Francis Galton. And so, although some of these areas might seem fairly kind of remote and not necessarily the things that would affect everyday people, virtually everybody, as I say, not just in this country but around the world, will have benefited to some extent from the work of Sir Francis Galton.
I guess with the weather, I mean, he must have like just recorded the weather each day so that you could then look at it, and then when you saw the same weather coming up, you could predict what was going to come. I mean, just to sort of break it down, obviously he would have been looking at pressure and cyclones and all the rest of it. But, you know, this is really important work that he was doing, and none of it's been disproven. I mean, it's politically incorrect now, but nobody's shown that it was wrong. I mean, the whole of the world was following this. America had policies that were in place with this. Germany did. Britain did. America kept up eugenics policies into the 50s. I think there's still accusations of them doing it now, where they try to sterilize, or they pay black people who have drug problems to be sterilized. And, you know, that's part of the negative eugenics that we talked about last week. Positive eugenics, you don't really find that so much now. But the whole of the Western world was engaged in this, in trying to improve the nation. I mean, why wouldn't you do this? And none of this has been proved wrong. It's just that it's politically incorrect, and it just gets associated with the Nazis now, so it must be wrong. Well, Galton was interested at first in the question of whether human ability was hereditary, and proposed to count the number of relatives of various degrees of eminent men. If the qualities were hereditary, he reasoned, there should be more eminent men among the relatives than there were among the general population. And to test this, he invented the methods of historiometry, using statistics to analyse references to geniuses, their statements, their behaviour, and their particular discoveries. So they didn't even know that you could inherit intelligence here. They must have had some inkling that musicians passed down through the family, and if there was parents that had musical ability, then the children are likely to have musical ability. But there was no science to actually prove this. And I think this idea of counting the number of eminent men in a family, and then taking the average from the population and seeing if there was more, I mean, this is quite a good way of proving it, basically. That it runs in families. And of course, today they'll say, oh, it's all because these children go to the posh school and that's why they succeed. No, it's not. The reason why the parents can afford to send them to the posh school is because they married wisely, because they chose their partner wisely, the same as their ancestors chose their partner wisely. And we have this theory, genetic similarity theory that Professor J.P. Rushton theorized, which is basically that you pick friends and partners that have a large amount of the same hereditary genes as you do, which means that you can look at your parents and they will look like you, but you can look at your great-great-great-grandparents and they will look like you as well. Because right the way along, your ancestors, if they were functioning properly and correctly and hadn't had lots of propaganda to go and race mix, they would have chosen people that looked like them, that had a lot of similar genes. And it means that a similar type of person to you would have been around in all the generations before, because that's who your ancestors would have picked as a partner, which shows you that what you have is hereditary. I mean, we are the sum of all our ancestors, basically. I mean, when you look in the mirror, that's what you're seeing, all your ancestors in your face. Well, he obtained extensive data from a broad range of biographical sources, which he tabulated and then compared in various ways. This pioneering work was described in detail in his book, Hereditary Genius, in 1869. And here he showed, amongst other things, that the numbers of eminent relatives dropped off when going from the first degree to the second degree relatives, and from the second degree to the third. And he took this as evidence for the inheritance of abilities. So that shows that the most bright person, they're going to have bright relatives, they're going to have, say, bright siblings, and the descendants of that very bright person, their children are going to be very bright, but the descendants of his relatives, their children are still going to be bright, but they're not going to be so bright. I guess this might fit in with the firstborn son, because they were always considered to be the the most eminent of a family, wasn't it? It was always the firstborn son that was seen as the most important. So I wonder if you found anything out about that, about whether the later offspring, whether they regress to the mean. Because we also get this thing called regressing to the mean, which means that you go back to the average. We get these people that are extremely bright, that pop up as a genius, but then their children will gradually revert to the mean, which is basically the average of that people group, which is why you can say, well, the blacks have an IQ of 75 in Africa and 85 in America. And even if you get a black guy with an IQ of 100, gradually his descendants will go back to that mean of either 85 or 75. So I guess he would have discovered that as well. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
Well, I guess that it kind of proves the importance of, you know, when you have a situation where there is uncontrolled immigration, as we have in most Western countries now, and where people are immigrating into Western countries from parts of the world where the average intelligence is lower than it is in the West, because some people say, well, you know, you're not affected by immigrants, that's none of your business. Well, the point is that it is some of our business, because if you incorporate within your nation people who come from stock where the average IQ is lower, then you are reducing the mean. And so where there is regression to the mean, the regression is going to go even further down, isn't it?
And that's what we see. You know, we see the average IQ in Britain is gradually going down each year. So on top of these dysgenic policies that, you know, if we didn't change them, we would still have, even if we were a white nation, we would still be going down in IQ. But because we have immigration as well, and the immigration comes from parts of the world where they have a low average IQ, then that brings the average down just by statistics. But by the interbreeding, it's even more harmful, you know, because the people there, you know, are going to have a much lower IQ. And I mean, he was actually the first guy to come out with the phrase nature or nurture and ask that question. But even with nurture, even with the best education, you can only increase an IQ by about 10 points. It can't go up any higher than that. And when you've got races of people whose average is, as I say, is 75, the very, very brightest people among them are going to have an IQ of about 90 or 95. And they're just not going to be able to get it up there into the 120, 130. I mean, amongst the white race, we have people with IQs of 130, 140. You know, these geniuses, which is what he was studying. Because a genius, as you said last week, Max, you know, a genius is worth an infinitesimal amount of money to a nation to have a genius. You look at all these things that he discovered, that he was the guy who created them. And that's just one man, just one polymath. And obviously you want to have as many of these types of people in your nation as possible, because they will discover so many new things. They will work out so many better ways of doing things, and it will improve the life of everybody in that nation. You do still need the laborer types, but these are the types that you really want. And if you don't have a eugenic society where you encourage the birth of these sorts of people, if you have a society that encourages immigration and rewards the dysgenic types, then you're going to get less and less and less of these geniuses, and life is gradually going to get harder and harder and harder for everyone. I mean, it really is just common sense. It's absolutely crazy the way that we've just ditched all of this and said, oh no, it's politically incorrect, it's bad, the Nazis did it. You know, we should have been leading the way with this, and we would have a far more utopian society if we had. There's nothing to stop the other races doing the same, you know, encouraging the breeding of their brightest and their best, rather than encouraging the breeding of those that aren't. I don't know if they engage in eugenics at all in the Arabian countries or in India. Obviously, in India, they have the caste system, and they do still have some very, very bright people over in India. But that also correlates with the fairness of the skin over there. The darker the skin, the lower the IQ, and the lighter the skin, the higher IQ. And the lightest of the skin over there is the highest caste. So obviously, if you have a caste system, you've got eugenics in play there, haven't you? Because you're saying only this type can only marry one of their own type. So the Hindus actually did have a eugenic system in their caste system. Maybe we should have added that to the bit about religion earlier, Max. Do you know much about eugenics in these other countries?
I don't have a great deal of, I don't have any information really of any great extent of the application of eugenics in other countries, other than just to say that, you know, that what you've just been saying is all correct. I think as far as third world countries are concerned, the problem they face from a eugenic perspective nowadays is that the people that tend to migrate and leave those countries to come to the West tend on average to be more intelligent than the ones they leave behind. And so in those third world countries, they should look upon migration as their brain drain. That was a term that used to be bandied about quite a lot back in the sort of 60s and 70s, brain drain, because we were all very concerned about our most intelligent scientists being poached and going off to the United States or somewhere else on fatter salaries than we could afford to pay them here. But the effect, the fact of the matter is that as far as third world countries are concerned, they are suffering from a brain drain. And what really needs to be done from in the best interests of those nations is for them to prevent migration and for them to implement eugenic practices in order to increase the intelligence of their general population. That is the key for them in terms of being able to generate a high technology society that will be wealthy. And it's in the interests of all of their people that they should do that. But in reality, what's happening is not only do we have a situation where mass immigration is damaging the Western world, but we have a situation where mass immigration is damaging the third world countries from which the migrants come.
You know, I can remember a school teacher saying something to me, and he would regularly repeat it: quality, not quantity. Quality, not quantity. And it's like we've completely forgotten that. You know, one genius is worth 1,000 low IQ people, because that one genius will be capable of advancing those 100 low IQ people far more than they would ever be able to advance themselves, even in 1,000 years. And that's just the way that it is. We seem to have forgotten that it's quality that matters and not quantity. Okay, let's start with a brief recap from what we were talking about last time. We talked a little bit about how he was a travel writer in his youth. He wrote two books, Narrative of an Explorer in Southwest Africa and The Art of Travel, which was a handbook of practical advice for the Victorian on the move, which is still in print. We talked about his middle youth and all the contributions that he made to the many different fields of science. We talked about the lab that he established in the science galleries of South Kensington Museum in 1888, which was to measure differences. And he would actually charge people to measure them, everything about them, their head size, their height, and also he would measure aspects of their personality and see if there were links between the two. He devoted much of the rest of his life to exploring these different variations that could be found in the various human populations and what their implications were. And he was basically interested in the question of whether or not human ability was hereditary, most of which he proved through these studies that he did, through these experiments that he did. And the results of that form the content of his book, Hereditary Genius, in 1869, which is still referenced today as a very, very important book. And we also talked a little bit about eugenics, because obviously he was the father of eugenics. And this was the work that was leading up to him really establishing this as a science. Is there anything you want to add to that, Max?
No, look, I think that seems to be a very good sort of potted history of him there. We mentioned previously that he's a polymath, that he's somebody, and that means that he's somebody who has got a very advanced level of academic ability in a wide range of different fields. And I think that You know, Francis Galton has been criticised by the Black Lives Matter movement because of the fact that he recognised racial differences, and he recognised even within racial groups that there were there was human inequality. But in terms of the scope of his studies and his work, you know, I think he ranks alongside people like Archimedes, Pythagoras, Leonardo da Vinci, people of that sort, in terms of his genius.
Well, I mean, that is some credit you're giving him there. I mean, the man must be really underrated, because he's not as well known as all those geniuses that you just brought up there, obviously, because he wasn't very politically correct, because the term didn't exist in his time. Well, twin studies also became very important to him. He recognised the limitations of his methods, however, and believed the question could be better studied by doing comparisons of twins. His method envisaged testing to see if twins who were similar at birth diverged when put into dissimilar environments, and whether twins that were dissimilar at birth converged when reared in similar environments. He again used the method of questionnaires to gain various sorts of data, which were tabulated and described in a paper, The History of Twins, in 1875. In doing so, he anticipated the modern field of behaviour genetics, which relies heavily on twin studies. He concluded that the evidence favoured nature rather than nurture. And he also proposed adoption studies, including transracial adoption studies, to separate the effects of heredity and environment. There have been lots of transracial adoption studies that have been done, which show that it is all nature. It's about 80% nature and 20% nurture. And I had a look on Amren, which is always very good for scientific studies, and I've just got a quote from there about twin studies. Recent studies of reared apart twins have shown that in general half the difference in personality and religiosity are genetically determined, but for a trait like IQ, about 75% of the variation on average is genetic, with only 25% influenced by the environment. And that's actually been upped now to 80%. It's 80% genetic, 20% by the environment, because they've done these transracial adoption studies where they've put black children in white families, where it's been said, oh well, white people are brought up with white privilege. So what they've done is they put these black children into white families. They've had the best schooling, the best education, and it still hasn't raised their IQ. It's still just as far below the average white IQ as a normal black child that was raised by black parents. And so he was looking into all of this in 1875. We've known this for 150 years, and still we're going along this path of diversity as a strength. And that wasn't until after the war, because all this stuff was established before the war, and it hasn't been discredited. They haven't come out with studies that disprove this. They just say that it hurts people's feelings, so we can't discuss it. Max, do you want to talk about his twin studies here?
Well, I think as far as the twin studies are concerned, you know, it is, as you've already stated, a very firm principle that lots of anthropologists a principle that they've adopted in order to investigate the relationship between nature and nurture. I think you're absolutely right in terms of the proportions of what constitutes somebody's abilities. Doesn't necessarily have to just be intelligence. It could be any kind of an ability, and that the it does work out to be something like 80% nature, 20% nurture. Obviously, if you get a child who is the child of two people who are geniuses, for example, just to use intelligence as it's a fairly easy subject to talk about, and you raise that child with a very poor diet, where they don't get the proper nutrients, where they're made to work very, very hard, where they get very little sleep, and that person at the end of the day will not be as intellectually gifted as they otherwise might be, and so they will perhaps be 20% lower on the scale than they would have been otherwise if they'd been raised with good levels of nutrition, with plenty of sleep, and where the amount of physical labor that they had to do was far more proportionate. Nurture does play a role in these things, and sometimes somebody will be born who will have great potential in a particular area, and they will suffer a a disease that's got nothing to do with the ability that they've got, but that disease may actually impair their ability in that particular area. They may have been born with the kind of genes that could, had they lived a very advantageous lifestyle, have become world-class athletes.
Yeah, I think twin studies got a very bad name with Joseph Mengele as well. They tried to sort of link him with all sorts of horrific things he did to twins, and that sort of gave twin studies a bad name. But of course, if you've got twins that have been raised in different environments and you ask them these questionnaires, and it turns out that in actual fact they are very similar despite being raised in completely different environments, then again, this proves that there is inheritance, and it is more nature than it is nurture. And of course, the environment is important. If you've got a bright child, then you want to give them as much stimulation as possible. And you want them to learn musical instruments. You want them to have private tuition as well as schooling. And if you've got intelligent parents, they're likely to be well off. They're likely to be able to afford all of this. Today, people will look at it and they'll say, oh, it's because they got rich parents, they can afford to do all of this. But it's not so much the rich parents, it's the inheritance that those children have got. It's the fact that 80% of their intelligence is already inherited from those parents. And the reason why the parents are well off is because their parents had were also intelligent. And if you start mixing one race, which has got a much higher IQ, with another race, which has got a much lower average IQ, that's going to lower the IQ of the children. And they're not even going to be starting out with the same as their parents had. It's like effectively hobbling the children before they've even had a chance to get going by mixing the races. Because if you had two white people together, their average IQ would be 100, and if you mix together with somebody who's black, the average IQ of the children is going to be 85. So rather than giving your children the best start out in life, you're giving the children a start out in life that could have been so much better if only people had chosen a partner who looked the same as them. This is just basic. It's not about hate. And he discovered all of this stuff way back in 1875. This was being talked about. As I say, it hasn't been discredited. They just say, oh, well, it's not politically correct to talk about. So this is the reason why he's not honoured in the way that he should be, alongside Pythagoras, as you were saying earlier, Max. Well, in 1873, Galton wrote a controversial letter to the Times titled Africa for the Chinese, where he argued that the Chinese, as a race capable of high civilization and only temporarily stunted by the recent failures of Chinese dynasties, should be encouraged to immigrate to Africa and displace the supposedly inferior Aboriginal blacks. Well, if you're going by civilization and you're having building civilization as the standard, and if you look at blacks, then they are inferior at civilization building when compared to the Chinese or when compared to the whites. And the fact that he was saying it would be good for them to go over there and displace them, well, that possibly wouldn't have been very good for the blacks, but it would have been an improvement for the Chinese. I wouldn't go along with agreeing with him in this. I think Africa should be left for the blacks. But at this time, they were just thinking, well, civilization is a good thing, surely. Surely if the Chinese did go over there and displace the blacks, they would build a civilization, and the effects of having that civilization there, that would improve the lives of the blacks that were there. They would then have access to medicine, communications, and it would help to raise them up by having this civilization there. Eventually, we had white people over there that built a civilization, but Africa is still nowhere near as civilized as the rest of the world. They've got a huge continent there, absolutely huge continent. There's no reason for them all to be flooding into Europe. And if the Chinese had moved in there, maybe Africa would be a lot more developed than it is now, and they wouldn't all be fleeing to Europe. Have you got a comment on his thoughts on civilization? Yeah.
Just to say that it's almost prophetic that Galton should have suggested this, because at the time, Africa was large parts of Africa were colonies of European countries, and Europeans were far more sensitive to the sensibilities of the Africans than I think that we have historically been given credit for. And as a result of that, we've been far more even-handed and taken a very softly approach in terms of the development of the empire. But the empire's now gone, and we've given those African countries their freedom. And what many observers have noticed in recent decades is that the Chinese are colonizing large parts of Africa now, not colonizing by military force or anything of that sort, but they're going into these African states that are failing, and they're saying to them that we will provide you with an electronic grid that will provide electricity to all of the various parts of your country in return for you giving us a monopoly of the electricity industry in the country. We will do this if you give us a monopoly of that. We will do something else if you give them a monopoly of this. A lot of people have been voicing warnings in the West that Africa is being colonized by the Chinese using economic colonialism rather than military colonialism. And so there is the saying that nature abhors a vacuum, and when white nations withdrew from their African colonies and gave those African colonies their freedom, they created a vacuum, and the vacuum was that there were too few people of civilization building capacity left in Africa. Because that vacuum has existed now for several decades, during which people like Robert Mugabe have made themselves rich, but who have not actually benefited their country one jot. So now we've got a situation where the Chinese are moving in to fill the void left by European countries who left. And so Galton, in this respect, has been proven absolutely right by history. I don't think it's a good idea necessarily that the Chinese are going in and are economically colonizing Africa. I think that from the African person's perspective, what should have happened in Africa is that the African governments should have applied a process of eugenics. They should have used Galton's eugenic principles in order to lift the average IQ of their people. Not that widely known, I don't think, but I'm a member of Mensa, which is the High IQ Society, some years ago I became aware of the fact that Mensa carried out a campaign where they tried to recruit Mensa members in Africa, and they made a big hoo-ha about it for a couple of years or so, but then suddenly realized that they, despite their best efforts, that they were just not recruiting more and more people of high enough IQ to qualify for Mensa membership. And I think that there was one particular point where I looked at the results of their work and that they had recruited something like 16 Mensa members throughout the entire continent of Africa. A disproportionate number of those were living in South Africa, which means that they were probably white anyway. And so this is the gulf that's been created. This is the void that's been created by us withdrawing. But if African leaders had applied Galton's eugenics and they'd taken those Africans who do have a Mensa level IQ and had provided them with a wherewithal so that they could have, say, 20 children, and for all of those 20 children to survive, then as each generation went by, the proportion of the African populations that have a very high IQ would have mushroomed, and if you regard a generation as being 16 years, then every 16 years the Mensa level population of Africa would have increased tenfold, and that's what Africa needs to bring it up to the same sort of standard that we are here in the UK and throughout the West.
That would, of course, created a vast improvement that would have much more improved their lives than kicking white people out and just encouraging as much breeding as possible. Some countries in Africa, 60% of them are under the age of 30. The other issue with the Chinese economic colonialism is that they don't interfere with the governing at all. They don't say, well, you've got to put these laws in here, you've got to have human rights here, you've got to have this there, you've got to have that there. They just say, well, if you'll pay us the money, we'll give you the loan, or we'll put the industry in there. Whereas at least with the British Empire said, well, you've got to have a system of law here, you've got to have police, you've got to have courts, you've got to learn about democracy, you'll have to go to school, and then we'll do all of this. But that is the big difference. At least with the British Empire, they were learning, and with the Chinese colonial empire, they're just getting loans, basically, and the Chinese are building stuff there. Well, Galton recognized that cultural circumstances influence the capability of a civilization's citizens and their reproductive success. In Hereditary Genius, he envisaged a situation conducive to resilient and enduring civilization as follows. The best form of civilization in respect to the improvement of the race would be one in which society was not costly, where incomes were chiefly derived from professional sources and not much through inheritance, where every lad had a chance of showing his abilities, and if highly gifted, was enabled to achieve a first-class education and entrance into professional life. By the liberal help of the exhibitions and scholarships which he had gained in his early youth, where marriage was held in as high an honour as in ancient biblical times, where the pride of race was encouraged, of course I do not refer to the nonsensical sentiment of the present day that goes under that name, where the weak could find a welcome and a refuge in celibate monasteries or sisterhoods, and lastly, where the better sort of emigrants and refugees from other lands were invited and welcomed, and their descendants naturalized. And of course, Wikipedia has put this in there to try and present this idea of democracy and everything else. And in actual fact, this is talking about how to improve the race. And when he talks about the better sort of emigrants and refugees from other lands, he means white refugees and white immigrants from other lands. And again, he is saying here that those that have are of a low IQ, are weak, sickly, got genetic deformities, congenital diseases, they should be encouraged not to breed. And he was saying here a welcome and a refuge in celibate monasteries or sisterhoods. He's not saying forced into celibate monasteries or sisterhoods, but a welcome there and a refuge there. He's not talking about forcing people to do anything. And this would improve the form of civilization that we had. Do you want to comment on this, Max?
No, I think that, well, I say no. It all of that again basically ties in with the overall philosophy that we've been looking at with Galton, where, you know, his major preconception was eugenics, the study that he gave the name to, and the improvement of the race, and the principles that he expounds, the principles that he uncovered and established, aren't racialist in the sense that they are white supremacist. Yes, of course he envisaged applying those principles to the white nations in order to improve the white nations, but the same principles apply to all of the nations of the earth. And so as we've just sort of been discussing, as far as African states are concerned, if they applied the same principles of eugenics to their own populations, then they could advance dramatically their own people for the good of everyone. And it's just a great pity that with political correctness, with Marxism, with universalism, etc., where the people expound the idea of human equality instead of actually studying human quality and qualities, the benefits of eugenics have been overlooked. And then obviously with the Second World War and the demonization of eugenics, because it was something that the Germans regarded as common sense, the study of eugenics has been neglected, and virtually every country throughout the world, not just the Western countries, but virtually every country throughout the world is suffering now, because we have too great a quantity of of people. And this is, you know, being recognized by people who are ecologically minded and environmentalists. They recognize that it is the massive population, human population that we've got, which is the problem. And the fact that, and it is the fact that the population is expanding, and it's the least academically adept sections of the population, in no matter what country you look at throughout the world, that is expanding, and the people of greater intellect are being encouraged by modern modern ersatz culture to value children and foreign holidays, to value cars and foreign holidays and big houses over having children. And so therefore the academically gifted sections of every population group throughout the world is falling at the moment, and that's a great tragedy, and it's something that needs to be turned around.
I do wonder if North Korea actually has any eugenic policies in place rather than dysgenic ones. And I think what Wikipedia is trying to do there, they're trying to push the idea of nurture rather than nature there. They're trying to say, to have a perfect civilization, this is what you would need. You would need to have everybody trained at school, not just the bright pupils and what have you. But they forget the fact that he's already established that 80% of it all is down to nature. 80% of it all is already down to inheritance. So that is only going to work with if you've got these brightest people there as well, and a large portion of them. If you've got the situation where we've got now, where we've got dysgenics, and we've got a large proportion of people that aren't really very productive members of society, then you're just wasting your time by wasting all that all those resources and all that education on people that aren't ever going to be able to do anything really, really good with it. You just end up wasting your resources on people that haven't got a hope of being productive, because their IQs are all under 80. Well, Galton finally invented the term eugenics in 1883 and set down many of his observations and conclusions in a book titled Inquiries into Human Faculty and Its Development. In the book's introduction, he wrote, "This book's intention is to touch on various topics more or less connected with that of the cultivation of race, or as we might call it, with eugenic questions, and to present the results of several of my own separate investigations. This is with questions bearing on what is termed in Greek eugenes, namely good in stock, hereditarily endowed with noble qualities. This and the allied words, eugenia, etc., are equally applicable to men, brutes, and plants. We greatly want a brief word to express the science of improving stock, which is by no means confined to questions of judicious mating, but which, especially in the case of man, takes cognizance of all influences that tend, in however remote a degree, to give the more suitable races or strains of blood a better chance of prevailing speedily over the less suitable than they otherwise would have had. The word eugenics would sufficiently express the idea. It is at least a neater word and a more generalized one than viriculture, which I once ventured to use." I think it's important to note here that he was well aware of the fact that we have limited resources. We live in a limited world, and quite obviously it's common sense to want the brightest, best, most noble people to proliferate in that world, because otherwise the brightest, the best, and the most noble are going to dwindle to becoming a tiny minority in that world, and they're going to be swamped by the brutes of the world, basically. And this was understood back then, that we only had a limited territory. This is why we went out and colonized the rest of the world. This was this drive that we had to survive and provide a better world for our ancestors and the other races and the other peoples. They would have had a better life with the more improvements that we built for our ancestors. But the drive was to improve your own people first. And that same drive could have, as you've been explaining, Max, could also have been carried out by all these other peoples. It ties in very neatly with nationalism, I think. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that as the world's population is increasing at the rate that it is, it's generally speaking making the world a poorer place. And it will increasingly make the world a poorer place, because the wealth of the world will have to be shared between a larger and larger number of people, and that can only be done by either finding some magic way of making the world richer than it is today, making the soil of the earth produce more food than it does today, finding untapped sources of steel and aluminium and all other kinds of resources than we have today, or people are going to get poorer. And one of the ideas that I've championed for a long time is that the key next step for mankind in terms of our development as a race is the ability to colonize other planets. Because if we don't learn to colonize other planets, then we will be like a race of people who live on an island and who have got a massive population increase and who eventually run out of resources and begin to starve, and then eventually a kind of equilibrium is achieved where the number of people being born just replaces the number of people who are dying, but because there is no improvement of the stock, no improvement of the race, the wealth of the population group doesn't get any higher. And the same thing will happen with the world, that the world will stagnate and human culture will stagnate with it because of the prevailing notions of human equality, etc., and the current denigration of ideas such as eugenics. But what we need I would say that an adoption of eugenics as a principle across the world would actually improve the entire world for everybody living in the world, but also it would enable us to have the mental capacity and sufficient people of sufficient mental capacity for us to start to colonize other planets. That's going to be the big thing, which is going to suddenly make available to mankind in general a massively greater natural resources than are available per capita to mankind at the moment. And it's just a great sadness, really, that in order to kowtow to the ideas of liberalism and Marxism and universalism, the budgets that used to be made available for space exploration in the United States have been cut back to the point now where the United States is no longer preeminent in that field. And as I said earlier on, nature pours a vacuum, and so what's happening is that the Chinese are advancing into that vacuum. They're putting a lot of money behind their space programs. The Russians are putting a lot of money behind their space programs as well, and hopefully a way out of our present malaise will come along, and we in the West will resume the position that was ours up until only probably 3 or 4 decades ago, where we were leading the world in that respect. And hopefully at some point in the not too distant future, the untold riches of the universe will become available to the people of this planet, and we won't have to subsist on just what this one planet can provide for us.
The improvements in the world around us come from the improvements in the race. If you lose all the civilization builders, then you're not going to be capable of building civilization. I mean, that they knew this back in the time of Greece. They said the problem with Athens is there are no more Athenians left, and that was it. The Greek civilization was over. Roman civilization, Egyptian civilization, all of them have all been lost when the civilization builders themselves are outnumbered by the civilization destroyers, basically, and that's why we have all these ruined civilizations around us. Well, Galton had some solutions to the problem. He believed that a scheme of marks for family merit should be defined, and early marriage between families of high rank should be encouraged via a provision of monetary incentives. We have something like this in Hungary now, although it's not families of high rank, it's just Hungarians that are at least being encouraged to breed, because we're not just suffering a problem of not the brightest people breeding now, we're suffering a problem of all white people aren't breeding enough to replace ourselves. So we are going somewhere towards this in Hungary, and also in Russia they're encouraging the Russian families and Hungarian families to breed. He pointed out some of the tendencies in British society, such as the late marriages of eminent people and the paucity of their children, which he thought were dysgenic. And of course, we've also got this promotion of abortion, feminism, contraception, the idea that it is just not fashionable to have children anymore, that all plays into this as well. Well, Galton advocated encouraging eugenic marriages by supplying able couples with incentives to have children. And on the 29th of October 1901, Galton chose to address these eugenic issues when he delivered the second Huxley lecture at the Royal Anthropological Institute. And I guess from 1901 onwards, up until about the war, they did pursue these ideas of encouraging the brightest people to produce more children. And I think that was at the time when we had the highest percentage of geniuses per 100,000 people, was back there at the turn of the century. The Eugenics Review, the Journal of the Eugenics Education Society, commenced publication in 1909. And Galton, the honorary president of the society, wrote the foreword for the first volume, and the first International Congress of Eugenics was held in July 1912 with Winston Churchill and Charles Eliot, who were among the attendees. And also America was very interested in this. Germany was very interested in this. Everyone was interested in this, and it's just absolutely insane that they turned their backs on this, because what we have now is dysgenics. I mean, he would be horrified to see what is happening in the world today, I think, Max. What do you think of his solutions here? I think the scheme of Marx is quite a good idea for merit, but I don't know how that would go down today.
Yeah, I think so. I think that where the church has gone wrong, the Christian church, is that it's concerned itself with alleviating the suffering of the poor instead of concerning itself with improving the stock of the many, basically. As with a lot of social services, there are gaps between social services that are provided that exist, where, you know, there's the term that's often used, which I don't like, the term of people falling down the cracks between, you know, the provision of one social service and the provision of another. But the point is that there needs to be something in our society that is the glue that holds everything together. And the clergy could have fulfilled that, and clergymen could have become the servants of an adapted Christianity that promoted the idea of eugenics, and where a local clergyman or priest would have had oversight over the lives of the people that live in their community, and it would have been their responsibility to make sure that where there was a poor family, but where they had, you know, children who'd got a great amount of academic potential, that poor family would in some way would receive financial assistance so their children could develop and could develop to their full potential, and therefore both benefit themselves and benefit society at the same time. So there are those kind of ideas that sort of run through things. And I think that one of the principles, which I can't quite remember who it was who came up, originally espoused this idea, but I think it might have been H.G. Wells, where he spoke of of mankind being divided into three different groups. One group who were the makers of civilization, the second group who were people who were capable of sustaining a civilization that had been made for them by the makers of civilization, and then there was the third group, which were the people who were of such poor quality that they weren't able to maintain a civilization that had even been gifted to them, and sort of explained the rise and fall of civilizations on the basis of the proportions that these people constituted within society, and that if you get to a situation where the proportion in your society of made up of people who can't sustain civilization, it becomes too great. And the proportion of the other two sections, the section that can sustain a civilization and those that can advance the civilization, become too small, then that civilization goes into decline. And that is the reason why we have the rise and fall of civilizations. And I think Francis Galton recognized this, and other people. Francis Galton had a protege who was called Carl Pearson, who continued his work after Galton died. There's lots of good stuff that Carl Pearson has written about, and did write about in the early part of the century, but has written about since. In more recent times, we've had the evolutionary psychologist Richard Lynn, who has espoused the same kind of ideas, where he advocated that in order to sustain a high technology society, a nation needs to have an average IQ of at least 90. And the work that Richard Lynn has done, though, has identified the fact that that the average IQ of the world is already less than 90. The average IQ of the entire world is in the region of something about 86. And so we are in a situation where if we act globally, then the proportion of people within our global population is now who have got the requisite 90 plus IQ is already too small, and that's why we need to have a greater recognition of human quality rather than quantity, and to organize the world in such a way that those people who have the ability to those people who have IQs above 90 have a greater degree of influence on world affairs than those peoples who have average IQs of less than 90.
Back down to the quality and not quantity. When I was a child at school, I had a particular teacher that used to keep drumming that into my head: quality, not quantity. And it's very, very true. I think you're right there about the church. They have concentrated on looking after the poor, and not just looking after the poor, but looking after the poor of the entire world, which is quite strange, really, because, you know, the Bible is all about inheritance. The Old Testament is all about inheritance and about people who are important because of their inheritance, because of who their fathers were. And yet the church has chosen to just concentrate on helping out the poor. It's and as I say, it's expanded that to helping out the poor from competitor countries, from people that are our competitors, which is a very bizarre thing when you think it was really the church that sponsored science originally, much as we're told the opposite. It was, it was churchmen, doctors of the church, that were doing these experiments, that were the brightest people in the past. Well, unfortunately, Galton, of course, has suffered from the fact that everything is now politically correct. And in June 2020, the UCL announced that it was renaming a building which had been named after Galton because of his connection with eugenics. And I suspect there's probably a lot more disavowals than that, because this was an incredibly intelligent man that would have had lots of things named after him. And if it's just one building that's had its name changed, I suspect there will be a lot more in the future when you look at what's going on with all these statues that are being pulled down. And this is the father of eugenics, who really should be held up, as you say, Max, up there with Isaac Newton and Pythagoras and all the rest. And yet most people have never heard of him. And yet, he's this amazing great Briton.
Carl Pearson has been disavowed by UCL as well. There was a laboratory named after Carl Pearson as well, or named in his honour as well, that's happened to. The key thing about this, though, is that all these politically correct organisations and people that are currently wielding power in within our institutions and are disavowing people like Francis Galton and Carl Pearson, they are very quick to do that, but they're not very quick to give back the money. The point is that they're quite happy to continue to enjoy the vast endowments that these great men created and that they gave to the learning institutions, so that they could prosper and so that they could expand upon the work that Galton and Pearson started, but the people who are the governors and the trustees of these institutions, they're not very quick to give back the money. Now, if Francis Galton existed today and he offered money to UCL, what would happen is that there would be an outcry in the press, and the UCL would turn and say, no, we can't accept money from a man like him, somebody who's a fascist, etc., and they would turn the money down. But and here they are now, they've had the money, they've had the benefit of the money for 100 years or so, and yet they're disavowing the man, they're dishonouring the man who gave them the money that has that enabled them to exist as a learning institution, but they don't have the moral integrity to give the money back, to find the surviving members of Galton's family and give them back the money. And that shows the hypocrisy of these organisations, and that's one of the most disgusting aspects of all of this. Or at least they should give the money to people who honour Galton and who honour Carl Pearson, rather than keeping it for themselves and using it for purposes that dishonour the men who gave him that money.
Yeah, and people like Cecil Rhodes. I think the problem is the products of these dysgenic unions are now the ones that are setting the policies and are driving all the Marxism. Dr. Edward Dutton has done lots and lots of work on this, showing that the people that support Marxism and support political correctness, they're all the sort of people that would have died out 150 years ago because they didn't have strong enough genes. And they've got defective minds as well as defective bodies. And unfortunately, they're the ones that are now directing policy. And the 10%, the minority that would have survived back then, that have got that are fully functioning and fully rounded individuals, we're the ones that don't have any power now. So everything that Galton predicted would happen if we didn't have eugenics, if we had a dysgenic society, is now coming true. Thank you very much for listening. If you want to hear more from Greatest Britons, it features in the second half of the Real Britannia podcast that we produce here at Radio Albion every Monday. Or you can wait until I edit them together into one podcast like today's one for the Greatest Britons series.